Andy Serling joins us from the New York Racing Association. Andy, good morning.
Don't ever play that song again, me or any guest.
Here's the thing.
I know you're very proud of yourself.
Yes, very clever. Andy, good morning. How's quarantine life?
It's a Groundhog Day, right?
Yes. Yes.
You just sleep later and later each day.
On the weekends I have. I've actually made it as late as 7 o'clock one of these last Saturdays or Sundays. Yeah. For me, that's crazy. For me, that's noon.
Well, that's really amazing. You actually are functioning on a day-to-day basis. I don't know what day it is, like most people.
I see a lot of that. People saying, they wake up and they have no idea what day it is. They've just sort of, things have blurred at this point.
Yeah, it's a little hard at times. At least there's some racing on the weekends. Been doing our shows. I'm not. Because at this point, there's nowhere for me to tape, even if I went out there. Because we've moved our base to Belmont.
Right. That's a good point. That with Aqueduct being co-opted, yeah,
there. Great point.
You bring up a great point.
Yeah, a little chilly at Belmont this time of the year.
Yes,
almost like a big refrigerator. It just keeps the cold air in until it gets really warm. So what's going on? What are we talking about today?
Well, we have to take advantage of your. Of your entertaining, the impresario role you have taken on Twitter, and there's some very interesting learning, I think, Andy, from these polls that you're creating daily, and it's made for great debate and discussion, and you've come up with some really interesting angles. You know, you tie some New York racing to national and historic racing. And it really feels like that it's a scenario where out of sight, out of mind, people have just forgotten about certain horses and they're having trouble putting them into perspective versus the ones that we've seen most recently.
Yeah. I mean, the polls are for people to make whatever they want. Nobody's grading them, and the results aren't going to change anything. I think that, we have to realize that what the polls show is that the demographic on Twitter and racing fans are younger and don't have as much sense of history. But, I mean, it's not clear because we had a poll recently where the horse who was the oldest, I think Coronado's Quest, who I really didn't think was the deserving winner as good as he was. I think people recognized him because they felt he had, because he had run after the race, but the whole point was Wise Horses never ran again. I don't think that Nicolas West was a better horse than Buddha, who beat Medaglia d'Oro and some very good horses, but he obviously a very good horse, but it's not always that case. There's a lot of familiarity, I think. It's more of a familiarity thing. Obviously Union Rag, anybody that really understood the four horses in that poll the other day, I think it was Champagne Winners that went on to win exactly one Triple Crown race.
Yes.
Anybody that really knew those four horses, Union Rags, probably would have beaten Sea Hero unless Sea Hero decided it was one of those 3 days in his career where he actually showed up and ran a good race. He was a very strange horse that had obvious real ability in what he did winning the Champagne, the Travers, and the Derby, and why he liked Moish in the track. The track was dry for the Derby. He ran that big race. But other races, he was just really extraordinarily mediocre. I was always disappointed in him a lot because I loved that family. It was a glowing tribute. And the only reason I hit that pick six on Travers Day was using him was that I was a fan. I was making out a ticket. And it was sort of a fun rush job and wasn't a very big ticket. And said, I have to use Sierra. I wouldn't want him to win and miss it because of him. I always liked him. But he wasn't. Except for those 3 days, he wasn't really very good. Ian Rags wasn't, he was good as a two-year-old, but his three-year-old form was just okay. He was never beating Timber Country. He wasn't beating Birdstone. Birdstone's a funny horse, and I think he did finish second in there. But I think a lot of people don't appreciate how good Birdstone was. And his big upset of Smarty Jones was, A, not a result of Smarty Jones getting this terrible trip. I mean, Birdstone was a few lengths behind him. It's not as though he was 20 lengths behind some sort of meltdown. And, you know, if people really watch some of these old races, they'll sense how the paces have changed. You know, we showed Hansel winning the Belmont, and Hansel was on top of a much faster pace than Smarty Jones was, or a faster pace, and he held up Strike the Gold, who was a good horse. You know, I know he didn't win after the Derby, but he was a good horse, and I think that people's understanding of pace has changed so dramatically because of these slow paces. And I put up that Florida Derby when Cornell's Quest went after Lil's Lad, and they went 45 and changed a mile and eighth. And I mean, Robbie Davis sent Cornell's Quest to do a drive around the half mile pole to go after him. And Lil's Lad was justifiably DQ'd for interfering late with Cape Town, but you know, they were a good 15, 20 lengths out of the field, and Lil's Lad ran much the best race. And it's not as though there weren't horses that survived these wicked paces. And I put that up in relation to the absurd claim that Frosted cost poor American Pharoah the Travers because a horse actually dared to force American Pharoah to go a sub-24 3/4 at some point during one of the big races as a 3-year-old. And God forbid anybody challenged him. Anyway, we took care of that, right, in the Breeders' Cup and made sure, you know, he's unchallenged and every good horse scratched out of it. But American Pharoah had cakewalks in his race. I think he's a very good horse, but he never faced the kind of pressure and kind of paces these horses faced in the past. And the suggestion that Smarty Jones was crossed to Belmont was Jerry Bailey went on some mission. It's silly. These paces are not even that fast in the terms of history. They just are in terms of now. And I think it'd be interesting to watch some of these races and see how different racing was back then. You know, there was times when Tom Durkin or the announcer would say in a relatively slow, you know, 46 4/4 half in a distance race. You know, now 46 4/4 is considered blazing. Just the evolution of the game. And people's perceptions have changed as the game has evolved, and they don't have necessarily the sense of history of how things used to be. You know, why was Dr. Fager so good?
Well, and that's what makes this exercise so intriguing, and I hope people, you know, not only look at the videos that you're putting up associated with the races or the horses, but you know, look at lifetime PPs, whether it's in Champions or whether you pull it up on Briz or more recently you can only go so far back on DRF, but you know, you like, for instance, the one you got today about the Frisette winners that then won the Juvenile Fillies, the Breeders' Cup. And here you're asking like a head-to-head matchup, Storm Flag Flying, Flanders, Indian Blessing, and My Miss Aurelia. And boy, that's an intriguing set of four.
Yeah, they're good horses. They really were. And, you know, I mean, a lot of the case could be made. Storm Flag Flying was a very, very good 2-year-old. I think a lot of people might have forgotten that because she had that disappointing 3-year-old year. And she was an okay 4-year-old, but her big win in the personal ensign was set up by that duel, Roar Emotion. You know, Jerry Bailey was on Roar Emotion, and they set up very fast pace against Azari. Azari ran an amazing race to run second. In a lot of ways, it was a very similar performance to that incredible race that Rachel Alexander, when she finished second at 1.25 in the personal ensign. And both cases, and people forget that was 1.25 back then.
Right.
In both cases, second to a Phipps horse, because persistently, yep. Was that the horse?
Uh-huh.
That was the horse to beat Rachel. But Storm Fly Flying, I bet Storm Fly Flying that day, but she was very fortunate to win. And she won because of the wicked pace, and Azari ran a remarkable race in defeat. I mean, maybe one of the best races she ever ran in her career. Well, that's a horse that, you know, people don't give the credit to Wayne Lucas that he deserves. He brought her back from the dead, essentially, right? I mean, her career seemed over. Back then, retired her. And, you know, she lost that. She lost the, I guess, them the Hempstead, became the Phipps to Sightseek. But then she beat her in the Gopher Wand at Saratoga. This is maybe Mr. Ruffy and Gopher, whatever we called it back then. I'm not sure. That race evolved. And she beat Fight Seek, and then she ran that huge race in the in the personal engine. And I guess that was 2004, right? And she ran in the Breeders' Cup Classic that year. I also think she ran in the, I believe she ran the Met Mile that year also. Wayne ran her.
That's for sure.
Yeah, but she had a very quietly very good year that year. And she had been, they had sort of given up on her at that point, right?
Well, and it, when it comes to, it's funny. I you know what I did? I pulled up and printed out the four charts for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies of these four that you're pitting: Flanders, Indian Blessing, Storm Flag Flying, and My Miss Aurelia. All four of them won as favorites, as it happens, in the Breeders' Cup, and some varying degrees of quality of field. But one thing is evident, Andy. They essentially, the four of them kind of, you know, had similar style. They all kind of wanted to be up on the pace.
Yeah, I mean, sort of line wasn't nearly as fast as the others. The Indian Blessing race, you know, the horses who were second and third were pretty good, right?
Yes.
Maxie Rhythm, who ultimately, you know, won the Garden City, but she's a very good turf horse. She was a pretty good dirt horse, too. And the second horse was Tao's Spell,
yep,
which I had forgotten. So it, yep, wasn't like she beat up on a bunch of tomato cans. They were good horses. I mean, I think probably the slop helped her get the two turns in that race, and it wasn't a super fast race. Warpass, you know, would have beaten her by maybe as big a margin as he beat the boys by. Listen, they were Breeders' Cup races. There were good horses in there. Flanders race was obviously pretty amazing. I mean, it didn't come up the fastest race in the final fig. I think it was low 90s, but that was a quick pace, too, don't forget. And, I mean, they beat Stormy Blues, and Stormy Blues, the horse I think finished up the closing third, the Sky Shulover horse, who had been the heavy favorite in the spinaway when Flanders beat her in Flanders' second start, and that was closing day at Saratoga, when I missed the pick six by using four or five in the race, and Cody's Key, the horse that won and beat me, I think Mike Hushin. But Flanders was very good. You know, I tell you an interesting note from that race. Because I remember very well that John Veitch, who was doing the commenting that day, he noticed on NBC very shortly as they were pulling up that Flanders was not pulling up well and not coming. I don't think she came back to the winner's circle, actually. And John noticed that very, very quickly on the broadcast. But that was unfortunately her last race. But
right.
When you consider how well she ran, and you consider what Serena Song did the rest of her career, now Serena Song likely improved, but Serena Song won the Haskell against the boys, I think, right? She finished second in the Whitney as a 4-year-old to Mahogany Hall. He just ran her down the very late stages. But she was Serena Song. I think she was like 15 for 22 lifetime or something.
She's an amazing, amazing
incredible
career.
Career record. She was an amazing horse.
If I had to, I guess this comes down, and the Indian Blessing kind of just ran them off their feet.
She was a sprinter, you know. Unless you really feel somehow she was going to bottom that field out, there was no way she was beating those horses. She was a very, very good horse, though. You know, it's not like she was a bad horse. She was really good.
This comes down to Storm Flag Flying and Flanders.
It does to me, but they're the two leaders also.
Yeah. And, you know, to my Miss Aurelia's credit, she beat Grace Hall, and we miss Frankie, the nice Peter Urton filly from the West Coast. Questing was in there as well.
Which year? When was this?
That was 2011's really, Breeders' Cup.
Questing didn't get her act together at that point. Breeders'
Not
Song,
yet.
By the way, was 18 for 38. She hit the board 32 of 38 times.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So she won the Haskell. Yeah. It was something. Really something. Yeah. I think it was Silver Bullet Day I was thinking of. That record. I think today's poll is going to be about the Suburban and New York Reds. Do you know, of the last, who won the Suburban this past year? Somebody what's his name? The Centennial Horse, Preservationist.
Preservationist.
From 2010 to 2018, in 9 runnings, 5 of them were won by 4 different New York breeds.
That's great.
Diversify, F&X, Field, and who is the 4th?
Run it down again.
Diversify, F&X won it twice. Haynesfield won it in 2010. And somewhere in there, another New York bred won.
Chad had that horse that had that got sick. That had the thing with the neck.
All horses get sick.
That's true.
You're right, it was Chad. It was Zevo.
Zevo! That was a barn favorite.
Zevo's half or full, I think half, broke its maiden on the turf at Gulfstream in a slow race about a month and a half, 2 months ago. Zevo is a funny horse. He was really kind of a mediocrity, to be nice, early in his career. And then he came back with a layup at Saratoga. And it's funny, I remember saying to Chad, who was favored, and saying to him, I don't like this horse at all. Am I missing something? He said, no, you know, he's just a horse. And he actually ran really well. And he either ran once or twice and lost, but he ran really well. I remember he was running at Belmont. I remember saying to Chad, like the day before the race, saying, I think Zevo can't, am I crazy? Zevo can't lose tomorrow. He said, can't lose. And he paid like 5-2 or something. And I think he rattled off like 6. Did he rattle off like a whole bunch of? No, I think he did rattle off a bunch of wins eventually in winning Suburban, like 18-1. He galloped. I'm thinking of Last Gunfighter is the horse that won like 7.
Ooh, straight. Last Gunfighter.
Yeah. Last Gunfighter. He took him over. He beat me. His first win, I believe, for Chad, I bet a tag horse that ran second to him, and it was the day that the Orioles lost game 5 to the Yankees. That horrible, horrible day. Because I remember leaving the track early, watching the race on my phone, waiting for the bus to get the Yankees game, but the game was starting relatively early. Things you remember.
Yeah, right.
To have horse racing is that trigger for memories.
Exactly.
You'll have a handicap this weekend?
The Oaklawn Stakes and the Oaklawn Mile.
What is the Oaklawn handicap?
Well, that's a good question.
And the apple blossom.
Well, another 2 weeks on the calendar.
Week, right, they moved it. Right. It
was, yes.
The Arkansas Derby would have been this weekend, and they moved those races the next week. I remember because I saw them all when I was there last year, but they moved them a week, right? Oh, so this year they're going to have that 3-year-old race as sort of a prep for the Arkansas Derby.
And
why
did
they run it last week and run it a month ahead? Before we get to 3, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, anybody
running in it?
A bunch of Brad Cox and Steve Asmussen.
You guys run a real. I haven't paid that much attention to Oakland, but
it's crazy.
He's on a big cold streak.
0-43.
Wow.
Nuts.
When it rains, it pours.
Very strange.
You know, the game is funny for everybody, right? It seems like when you're going right, whether you're a horse player or a rider or a trainer, you know, the things seem to work out. And when you start going bad, things just start to, as they pile up on you, you know?
Yep, that's very true.
And it'll turn around overnight. And, I don't think that the Asperson barn is doing anything differently than they've been doing. There were a lot of horses, so it's probably not even that long a period of time, right? Even at this stage, you know, even at this stage, it's probably a matter of 2.5 or 3 weeks, right? I mean, they could run 43 horses in a weekend in normal cases.
But, yes.
But obviously there isn't as much running, but they're still probably running a ton of horses. So it's not even that long a period of time. I mean, who knows why, barns go. But every barn goes through them. You'll see it. I mean, we've seen Todd go through. We saw Chad had a bad run, right? Didn't he have an 0-19 Saratoga or something? And a lot of it, it's hard. I haven't paid any attention. I don't know how many of them are shortish prices. It is sort of amazing, if you do the math on it, and over 43 is pretty significant. But, I tend to think it's like when you're a horse player and you have these streaks where you just can't seem to do anything right. You lose, you know, 15 straight days in the track, and, you know, when you're playing a lot. And it's just like, geez, I mean, randomly, you're supposed to occasionally bet winners, right? No matter who you are. And and it seems like when that's happening, every little decision you make is the wrong one, and everything
yep.
you do sort of goes against you. People can sit around and try to figure out why, as opposed to, I think, okay, it's just, you know, it's, I don't know that it's necessary. And I haven't followed it, but, you know, so much stuff is fooled by randomness, right? A lot of things in life are fooled by randomness.
Well, and that's one of the biggest challenges of, you know, of handicapping in general, is discerning.
Yeah, but I think as a handicapper, I think it's like anything, you know, if they're running short priced horses and there's a bad run going on, you know, you may be using them in your multis, but, you know, you may feel some confidence playing against them. Obviously, if Steve runs a horse that's 8-1 or higher and you like the horse, I don't think you can't care less what the streak is, you know? You like or it's the price, and you think the price is fair, you're not supposed to say that. It's like stats, you know? It's there's a very idiotic notion by people that, you know, those of us that give out stats are being critical, you know? And I've had some trainers, not many, most of them get it, but they're, A, confused by stats, but B, that think somehow it's an insult. I don't make the stats, and handicappers don't make the stats. The trainers make the stats, and I think, you know, like I've said all the time, you know, you use stats, positive stats in general for bigger priced horses to say, hey, here's an interesting thing about this horse that's a little under the radar. And you use a negative stat on relatively short priced horses as food for thought. It's not like we're running out there and saying, I'll never bet this horse because the trainer has this crappy record in this situation. It's just food for thought. I mean, every handicapping angle you give out, every opinion you give out is food for thought. They're not absolutes. There's nothing absolute out there. And I think sometimes, you know, you will have, like, you know, in a usual situation where Todd Pletcher has these great numbers with maidens off long layoffs. And you'll show us that and say, listen, I know this horse is going to be 6-5, but believe it or not, you might wonder and say, you know, Todd actually does remarkably well in this situation with these horses. So if you're thinking of not betting because of the layoff, in general, it doesn't seem to be a problem. And that's more of a discussion point. But for theoretical betting purposes, positive stats for long shots, negative stats for short prices. But once again, this notion that we go in the air and we're using it to criticize a trainer, well, that's idiotic. And only morons think that, to be perfectly honest. We're doing it to tell, our job is to try to help the bettors. And the interesting thing is there's a misconception that trainers don't understand that. Trainers do. Trainers do understand. There is a disconnect, I think, that the horsemen somehow are against bettors. I have not experienced that to any degree in New York at all. And I don't find, you know, the very few examples of a trainer that gets mad because you have a bad stat is, it's few and far between. And I think the one thing you do want to remember is you don't need to pick on the little guy, you know. Or, you know, I mean, if you have a trainer that struggles and doesn't have a lot of horses and their stats are mostly made up of running bad horses and long shots, there's no reason to put up a stat pointing out that they have barns full of bad horses every year. You have to be discerning in that manner. But for the bigger barns, the barns with a lot of stats, stats are what they are. They're not meant as some sort of personal insult. And if they're taken that way, it's unfortunate.
And that, you know, it's funny you say that.
Yeah, I mean, if Steve is mad because somebody's pointing out the stat, Steve's frustrated because he's going through a bad
stat. Sure, sure.
Listen, we all get mad at, you know, we all get mad at people or things, you know, you kick the chair because the chair got in your way when you tripped over it. You know, it's like, you know, I don't really think it's personal, you know, stats. But if you're doing your job properly in any kind of public handicapping, you do have to point these things out, and I'm sorry, but if somebody doesn't like it, then that's not your problem. Because the same token, when these people are doing really well and things are going well, we point that out as well. So you can't always, it's like the riders, you know? You know, you're complimentary of riders, and this perception that I'm, all I do is beat up on riders, and that's just also nonsense. I'm incredibly complimentary of riders quite frequently, but, you know, I can't, it's like, I think Joel Rosario is as good a rider as there is in the game, and I'm constantly positive about him, and personally, I happen to like Joel a lot. gave some bad rides on Florida Derby Day. You have to point that out. You can't have any credibility if you're not honest in both ways. Now, I have this conversation with another rider in Saratoga. There's a friend of mine. I criticized one of his rides, and I said, you and I are friends. I can't, you know, constantly be positive about you and not point out when I think you made a mistake. I have to have some credibility. And I think the riders, it's hard for them, and they don't want to be critical, and they're fighting for mounts, and you're in Saratoga, and there's a lot. But my job is to give the information I think is most important for bettors, which may or may not be accurate information all the time, or people may not perceive that it's accurate or agree with me, but I have to give what I believe my opinion is, within fairness. But most of the time, it's pretty complimentary, and I think anybody that actually listens to me knows that I'm incredibly complimentary the majority of the time. I don't care what anybody says.
Well, it's funny. earlier today, we had Kent Sweezy, and we were going through a race that he's in tomorrow at Tampa, and Vicky Oliver, who you know is notorious at Keeneland, and here she is. She's stuck down at Tampa, and she hasn't won since the beginning of the year. Just like 13, I think, over 13, and. You know, I said, boy, if anybody's missing Keeneland, it's Vicky Oliver, who would have won three races opening weekend at Keeneland. But it's not a knock on her. I mean, everybody knows she wins.
Well, I mean, listen, you know, I mean, it's right now is a difficult situation, especially with a lot of trainers. You know, I think a trainer like Rusty Arnold, right? Who you often see him sort of use, like a lot of trainers. You know, he may win a race or two in Florida, but mostly he's pointing towards Keeneland. And he's always been a trainer that seemed to win races at Keeneland, especially in the spring. I would pay more attention to spring, so I can't really comment as much in the fall. And a guy like him, right? What does he do with horses that I'm sure, like a lot of trainers, pointing to Keeneland? You know, listen, it's a very, very tough time for owners and everyone involved in the game, and, you know, a very frustrating and tough time and expensive time as well. All we can hope is that we're able to get back racing sooner than later, but obviously safety and people's health, you know, overrules everything. I don't think there's any question of that. And nobody's saying that's not the case, but it's a tough time. And you know, you feel for people that are involved in the game, owners that are paying the bills, but people work on the backstretch especially, and you want them to be safe, but it's hard because this is the year is starting to really rev up, right? The racing season begins at Keeneland in April. And say whatever you want. That's when, you know, people point for serious racing and grass racing comes back, and we have grass racing at Aqueduct, and then we go to Belmont and all these things, and this is severely delayed. A lot of important big races are being missed. But it can't be helped. It's not as though people don't want to race, but it's a tough time.
Well, and one of the long-term effects that's going to be interesting to watch is the juveniles. John.
Training, Steve, I don't know. I don't think, you know, who's the last junior juvenile from Keeneland? I guess Kamari won this weekend, but the last really top horse I think that broke his maiden at Keeneland was More Than Red. If there's another big one in there.
I'm not necessarily referencing.
They're training. I mean, they don't start running until Del Mar and Saratoga anyway.
Well, those are the biggest, but certainly by May, June, there's 2-year-old races that are.
Yeah, but those races historically are no longer filling up our big races. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think hopefully we'll be back racing in time for these juveniles. I don't agree about the juvenile argument. The horses are getting hurt, or the whole stakes schedule. You know, I mean, you can say, well, there's big race at Keeneland, but it's also when horses are getting started for the year by a lot of the big outfits and a lot of the good horses. You know, they're backed up. It's like, okay, let's just say, for argument's sake, I don't have some information. I'm not giving it. I'm using an example. Let's say the races of like Belmont Day and races at Churchill or in June are able to be run. But where are these horses coming from that are filling these stakes, right? Where have they been prepping? Well, the turf races, they haven't been prepping anywhere, right? You know, maybe some of them ran at Oaklawn, but for the most part, these horses, you know, haven't been running at all. So it's changed that, I think, much more for older horses. I don't see how it's backing up 2-year-old racing.
Well, there's a couple different things that are going to figure into this. The homebreds, and for people who might have bought at the OBS sale that was able to be snuck in. We're not going to see the distribution of the 2-year-old, you know, the 2-year-olds in training now until May and June.
See until April or May of the following year anyway. I mean, the fact that there have been a number of 2-year-old sales canceled becomes problematic.
Yeah.
I don't know how that gets dealt with, but that's problematic. But it's not as though all those 2-year-old sales horses come rushing out of the gate in May and June, Steve. They don't. They just don't.
No, I'm just saying, if the pipeline, it's a funnel.
It's very problematic for a lot of different people in the game, breeders and, you know, owners,
everybody,
people involved. And yeah, no, it's no question about that. I agree. I mean, the game is always going to have, you know, it's an ecosystem, and you know, obviously, this is going to greatly affect the breeders as well. So it's not, you know, it's not as though they're unaffected by any long shot. It's affecting everybody involved in the game. It's involving everybody in the country, in the world.
Yep.
Yeah. Who's on next?
I think you'll get a kick out of it. Mike Jakubowski.
Sorry, the joke of that is lost on me. But
he's the president of Fonner Park and the CEO of
Pick Five carryover today.
They've got their jackpot force out today.
The force out. What race?
Yes.
Six or five.
Races five. Races 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Should I be looking?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a terrific sequence. I went over it with Nick Tamaro to start the morning.
Really? Nick's pretty busy these days.
Well, he's got the
he's so busy he was just texting me. All right.
He's coming back on tomorrow to do the Tampa Pick 5, too.
He's the man. He's the man. Race 4. What? What time does that go off?
Late. It'll keep you occupied. It starts at 6:21, first post for the fourth race.
Oh, so they're 1 hour. Where is Fonner Park located?
Grand Island, Nebraska.
How did I not know that?
Well, you've gone out there, right? You've gone to Horseman's Park for a seminar.
I've been there twice.
You, Steve, Christ, who else would they bring out?
I don't want to cut into the.
No, I've got.
All luminaries of racing except you, Steve. I don't want to cut into his time. It's been a pleasure. I'll talk to you later.
Goodbye, Andy Serling, everybody, and Andy keeping you busy on Twitter with his daily polls. If you haven't been participating, you should. It's a fun conversation, and lots of great historic. Moments, videos, and discussion. And it'll help you if you're fairly new to the game. It'll enhance your understanding of the game's history. I mentioned that we're going to be joined by Mike Jakubowski and Mike, the president of Fonner and the CEO of Dinsdale Automotive in Grand Island, and we'll talk to him about what's gone on here with Fonner. It's a remarkable story, really, and horse players responding, showing great resilience and flexibility. That's why we love you. And, you know, I should mention, too, good opportunity at Thorograph. I was just texting I was hearing back and forth from Jerry Brown. And I do owe Jeff Franklin a visit. And Jeff is running the Thorograph Player Services, TGPS, which, you know, over the last about year and a half, I think we've had one conversation going back a couple of summers when Jerry was introducing it. If you're a member of Thorograph Player Services and you then are betting through Naira Bets, all kinds of benefits, including free sheets. And there's also, whenever we get back to the racetrack, there's terrific on-track benefits as well. But it's easy to sign up, and TG Player Services gives you free sheets Monday and Tuesday. You get all, not just for Will Rogers and for Foner, but if you, you know, it's really a, whether you're a regular Thorograph user or whether you're, you know, somewhat new to it, you should be signed up. This is a terrific program that hasn't gotten nearly enough attention. I'll get Jeff Franklin on. And, of course, a lot of you know Jeff from TVG days, and Jeff, one of the, you know, long-term creators in a lot of ways of ADW services as it developed, along with Johnny D is another one, right? Tony Olivato. I mean, there's, and who did I have on? Tom Aronson had that great conversation a couple of years ago. Actually, that should be on the best of, because Tom told the whole story of how TVG came about. Really interesting. And remember those days, the signal wars, and if you were with one ADW, you couldn't play these tracks, and people forget. I mean, that was a nightmare. Remember back when, that's what, 10, 12, maybe even longer. I moved from Canada in 99. So right after that, yeah, 2000 to what, about 2005, 6, 7? The great signal wars of the aughts. You'd have to have, you know, I mean, most of us have multiple accounts anyway, but then you'd really needed multiple accounts because you couldn't play certain circuits on certain platforms. Anyway, Thorograph Player Services, TGPS, go sign up. Looking forward. We'll take a break here, and Mike Jacobowski joins us after this. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Back at the races about 15 to noon on this Tuesday, and of course later this afternoon into the early evening, Fauner Park and the Dinsdale Automotive Jackpot Pick 5. And when this season started at Fauner, I cannot imagine that Mike Jacobowski and the team at Fauner could imagine that they would be getting the attention they're getting now. Mike, good morning.
Steve, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure, and we've been kind of, you know, obviously we're everybody trying to make the best of this. This is such a difficult circumstance, and Chris Katulak, who, whether there was a pandemic or not, was going to work his ass off for Fauner, but this circumstance is just kind of organic because of the situation, and the horse players have really responded to Fauner.
You know, they sure have. We've had a tremendous change, you know, since Chris decided to go to take a shot at horse racing in Nebraska with no people in the stands. It's something, obviously, you know, you don't run into every day. And it was a brilliant move on his behalf. And the horsemen, they all thought it was a great move. And obviously, you can see by the handles that Fauner Park's just having a tremendous meet with the hands, you know, the cards they've been dealt.
Well, and you know, I wanted to just kind of provide a tip of the cap to Dinsdale, and I've had so much fun, you know, kind of mirthfully, you know, advertising with the jackpot as it's grown. And, you know, Chris joined us a few weeks ago when the transition to the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday started. But you're also president of Fauner. Talk about your own racing interests and you know, your association with the racetrack and Nebraska racing.
Well, I've been going out to Fauner Park since I was a child. My mom used to be a teller at the windows back in the 70s. So I've been sneaking into the track for a lot of years. And along the lines, I've owned many horses with a couple racing stables, IBC and U and Seven Arm Stables. And you know, when my chance got to be on the board at Fauner Park, it was just kind of a natural fit. And, you know, auto dealerships, especially Chevy dealerships, in over the course of history have always kind of been there to help the community. And Fauner Park is a huge part of the community. And when we got the chance to sponsor this Pick 5 jackpot, it was just a match made in heaven. It was a baseball, apple pie, Chevrolet, and horse racing, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. And in fact, let's give everybody some background, you know, because having lived in Kansas City and you know, having gotten to Exarban, that's, you know, that, for me, is my, you know, my Nebraska racing experience. But as we saw from early in the meet, I mean, right in, and I think in early January or February, and I saw the you know, the video of the packed house, you know, 10,000 people on the apron and in the stands. But talk about Grand Island and the whole circuit too, Lincoln and Columbus and then Omaha. You know, really, it's the first half of the year, essentially, from January to about June, July to the State Fair. I mean, it's a horse crazy area, Mike. I mean, Nebraska has a great racing history.
You know, we really do. You know, Lincoln and Omaha and Columbus and Grand Island, I think we're pretty proud of the product that we put out there every day that we do run. We get a lot of support from the area, and, you know, we face a lot of challenges every day, too, being one of the smaller tracks, you know. But, like I said, where if you'd come and spend a Saturday at Fauner Park during the live race meet, you know, in circumstances other than today, you'd see just the fan base and the people that get together for just an awesome day at the track. People really, they unite and come together.
Where geographically, explain for people that, you know, that are watching the signal, but explain Grand Island and its, you know, and its positioning geographically.
Geographically, we're almost right dead center in the state of Nebraska. We're about 9 miles north of Interstate 80, so we're easy to find. Fauner Park is also the home of the Nebraska State Fair, so that the grounds there. So it's real easy to get to. We've got an airport you can fly in, fly out. It's kind of right smack dab in the middle of things.
Did you grow up in that region or?
Born and raised, Steve.
Born and raised in Grand Island.
Yeah, born here and then been here ever since. I've been selling cars for the last 28 years. I understand you've got a 2019 you might need to get rid of.
Absolutely not. I got a brand new Impala. I've got, this is my second Impala. My first car as a kid was a 71 Impala. That was my mother's car. And after a series of Bonnevilles, I went to, and when you want to talk a faithful GM customer, the first car I remember as a kid was a Dynamic 88 and then a Delta 88. And then my mother also had a Monte Carlo and then the Impala. And ever since I've been old enough to buy my own cars, I bought six straight Bonnevilles, including an SSE, and then went to the Impala. And heartsick that this may be the last Impala I'll get to own.
Right on, right on. Well, you've got my number. If you're ready for something different, you let me know. But in the meantime, we're awfully excited about this pick five today. It's just going to be awesome. You know, I think the carryover going into today was just shy of $500,000 or $500,000.
Yep.
And we're hoping for $2 million, $3 million. We don't know. We'll see what the day brings.
I asked Nick Tamaro early in the show when Nick and I handicapped the sequence, and Nick thought $2 million. I think closer to $3 million. I won't be surprised if they add another $2.5 million to it today.
I wouldn't be either. You know, it's one of the only shows in town at that time of the day. So
exactly.
There's a lot of horse players out there getting a lot of attention thanks to TVG and so we're real excited.
You should be. And how much benefit? I mean, obviously the handle is the benefit to the racetrack, but how much recognition? I mean, you've got to see the chatter about, because I think the horse playing public has sort of, you know, taken a shine to Dinsdale Automotive.
Well, I sure hope so. You know, the first year we did this thing, we guarantee every day the first $5,000. If it gets hit right away, we pay it, and we restart it, of course. And so the first year, I think we had to pay three times. The second year, maybe once. And I don't think we've paid the last two, maybe two and a half, 3 years. So it's been kind of a good thing. And with the national recognition, anytime you can get that, I mean, we're excited. Heck, if we can sell a car out of this thing, too, more power to it.
I'm going to ask you for an opinion or two in the sequence, but before it gets too late, let's also give everybody the details. DinsdaleAuto.net. And, you know, if you're within, you know, delivery range in the greater Midwest and essentially, you know, you could be in Kansas, you could be in Manhattan and it's directly north Grand Isle. I mentioned, you know, Kansas City. I did buy a 1959, Oldsmobile, 88 off of a used car lot in St. Joe. 2600. It had 26,000 miles on it, Mike.
Nice.
I'll send you a picture of that, actually.
Okay.
Because I was born in 59 and I had the Oldsmobile affection. But DinsdaleAuto.net and some nice deals on the website, and we hope some people take advantage. I do have to ask you, you know, looking over at the map now, you know, you're directly west of Omaha on 80, and I can remember when we went to Exarban, my buddy Phil and I, and then we went to Johnny's in the Stockyards.
Sure.
It was either Johnny's or Ross's Roost?
Might have been before my time.
Okay, all right. What's your steakhouse of choice in Omaha?
In Omaha, that's a great question. We like a breakfast joint called the Early Bird. You need to check that out. It's an awesome spot.
All right, the Early Bird. And if people if people come to Grand Island?
Grand Island is easy. The Grand Island Saddle Club or Texas T-Bone. There's some good places here. But let them know that, you know, we deliver cars nationwide. We sell Chevrolet, GMC, trucks for all the horsemen. We sell trailers. We can help you get you whatever you need.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Mike Jacobowski. Mike, you got a play or two? You got an opinion or two from the sequence today?
I'm in with a group of guys who think that they're smarter than I am, so I'll just keep losing with them.
I tell you what, I got a question already for you. Derek Lawson, the agent for Flavian Pratt, do you have the new Corvettes yet?
We do not, and we're hoping to get one any day soon. You know, that's production assembly has been on hold right now, so everything's just kind of up in air. I hear sometime in May they might get the ball rolling again and get those cars coming out.
All right. Well, I'm going to send Derek your contact information because he every time Pratt wins another $1 million race. In fact, I think Derek's probably still got his Derby money to spend. As Flavian's agent. Well, I Mike Jacobowski, congratulations on a great season. There's still several weeks to go. This pick five will probably build up again too before the end of the season. But horse players nationwide appreciate what you and Chris Katulak and Steve Anderson and everybody Fawner has really earned a place in everybody's heart.
Thanks, Steve. Hey, everybody out there, stay safe.
Mike Jacobowski at Dinsdale Automotive in Grand Island. And now you know, for those of you that have always wanted somebody in the auto business, here you go. You got you got somebody to reach out to, and before you make a deal, run it by Mike and see if he can't beat it. And they'll deliver it anywhere, nationwide. How about that? just about a minute to wrap up. I couldn't resist. The Americana appeal of this was irresistible. Mike Jacobowski, thank you. We'll finish our plays later after the scratches come out, and we'll fine tune it and make any final adjustments and maybe we'll get some help from the scratches. We'll see. But for now, the four in the eighth race gone preaching feels like the big lean for me. And the sixth, the race that is going to be potentially the most challenging. Make sure you get through the first leg, the fourth, where, as Nick and I kind of agreed, the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I mean, if you can afford it, with the 5, 6, 7, slightly preferred, the 4 and the 6 in that fifth race, going to spread in the sixth, the 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, even the 4 and the 6. I mean, if you can afford the all button, the 6 feels like the race to do it. And then we're going to lean again on the 3 and the 5 in the 7th. Mayflowers and Extreme Caution. And then Gone Preaching. So 2 by 16 by 2, 32. By 3, 90, yeah, somewhere between $48 and $96, I think, is probably a ticket. First leg goes off at 6:21 Eastern. Got to thank Nick Tamaro. We'll talk to Nick again tomorrow to go through that challenging Tampa sequence. Kent Sweezy, we had a lot of fun with Kent. Jen Shaw from Dean Dorton to help you with your applications to offset losses and income interruption. Andy Serling and Mike Jacobowski from Fauner Park and Dinsdale Automotive. Good luck today on the sequence. We'll recap it tomorrow, and we'll be together 9 a.m. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. SteveBick.com for the archive and podcast. Talk to you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks.